Welcome to LILAS, the Teresa Lozano Long Institute of Latin American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. This is LILAS Associate Director Juliet Hooker, and I'd like to invite you to listen to the podcast of this important event held recently at the Institute. We have begun posting podcasts of many of our public events online in order to make more of the rich variety of our outstanding programming on Latin America available to a wider audience beyond the university. We hope you find them informative and enjoyable. Please come back and listen to more of what we do at LILAS.
The presentation I'm going to make here actually is not really primarily about the research that I have already conducted on the experiences of Mexican undocumented coming across the border into Texas during the late 1990s and the first half of the past decade. These results of this study are published in a book called Clandestine Crossings. It came out at the end of 2009 with Cornell University Press. Those of you who are interested in the book, I have two copies at a very heavily discounted price. Come see me afterwards, and I'll be happy to make them yours. The other thing I'll point out is that the book is accompanied by a free website that has oral histories of migrant and Coyote experiences that you might be interested in taking a look at, even if you don't decide to purchase the book. But what I want to do is I want to talk about the lessons of my research that I think may be relevant to, if not interpreting what's going on with regards to violence against migrants in Mexico today, at least pointing in some directions for further research and some hypotheses to be explored, okay? And so that's what I'll be mainly talking about today. In this book, in a very summary kind of fashion, I argue that U.S. Border enforcement has come to resemble something that other authors have referred to as global apartheid. Global apartheid is this concept developed way back in the 1970s by an international relations specialist at Princeton named Gernot Kohler, that said, isn't it interesting that by the late 1970s, the apartheid system in South Africa is receiving universal condemnation as gross human rights violations, and that it's viewed as being completely unacceptable for people within a state to be treated as having distinct sets of rights within that state based on race and forms of belonging that, if not nationality, are similar to nationality with the Bantustan system that was in place and the pass laws that one had to obey in order to travel in and out of these Bantustans. And he said, isn't it interesting that as there's this universal human rights condemnation of South Africa, that if you look at the contours of the emerging post-colonial world in the 1970s, the situation looks rather similar, except that the differences between white and black or brown areas and wealthy and poor areas are at the international level and are enforced with similar mechanisms at state boundaries, okay? So he says there's an analogy that can be made there. And I developed this concept a bit further in my book with regards to talking about North America and what goes on between Mexico and the United States. It's a deliberately provocative framework to use. The idea is to get us all thinking about human rights and what it means to enforce the boundary between the United States and Mexico and, by extension, the rest of Latin America in this way. And I argue in the book, essentially, that migrants, when faced with apartheid-like conditions, resist their territorial confinement in an effort to basically claim a greater part of the surplus their labor produces by traveling to the United States, laboring here for better wages than they can ever hope to expect in their homelands, and that they do this by overcome the barriers placed in their path by hiring service providers known as coyotes, also known as polleros, pateros, and there's some other names as well. And I suggest that we might think of their hiring of coyotes and their travel to the United States, where even though they are going to be super exploited based on their undocumented status relative to natives, they're still getting something meaningful and objectively measurable out of it, which is higher wages, a greater return on their labor that they can in turn use to support themselves and their families either back in Mexico or increasingly here in the United States. And I argue that they make this all possible principally by drawing upon resources available to them in their social networks, primarily financial resources, but also cultural resources in terms of knowledge about the roots and how to go about hiring a coyote to successfully get through the ever greater barriers placed in their paths, and that one of the principal features of this that becomes relevant to the question of kidnapping in Mexico and the United States of migrants is the COD system that comes into play, whereby migrants don't pay most of their fee for traveling with a coyote to the United States until they reach their destination, or at least their initial destination in the United States, after passing the gauntlet at the border. And what that means is that having criminals know that a sum, and a rather large sum of money, is available if they're able to extort migrants in transit, that creates a tremendously remunerative crime of opportunity for criminal elements in Mexico, but also in cities like Houston and Tucson and Phoenix and Los Angeles in the United States. Okay, and trying to think if there's anything else I want to tell you about the arguments of the book. Oh, the other thing that I argue in the book, that in spite of the vilification of coyotes by the authorities and in the press, and in fact by some human rights organizations, that the main dangers that Mexican migrants coming into Texas faced had to do with the rigors of the journey. In other words, these long treks through very harsh conditions where it was possible for people to die of heat exposure, die of exposure to the cold, drown in the river, die of thirst, et cetera, or to be severely injured along the way, and less so by actual direct acts of violence perpetrated against them by their coyotes, as the law enforcement authorities here always argued. And I just have some photographs that I'll go through very quickly of what the increased fortification of the border looked like in South Texas in the late 1990s and the early 2000s. Ah, I should also mention that my field work for this research ended in the first month of 2006, which means that it is prior to Felipe Calderon taking office, prior to the frontal assault on drug trafficking organizations that began in 2006, and that most observers regard as the detonator for the rising levels of cartel violence that has we've been seeing since then. So just some photographs. This is actually near Granjeno, Texas. This is Anzaldúa's Park in Hidalgo County along the river, being patrolled by jet skis, roads being cleared of footprints every morning so that the agents can cut for sign, attempting to track migrants as they come through the area away from the river. We have ATVs, cuatrimotos, that are being used in the brush. Lots and lots of new vehicles. Perreras, they call these, paddy wagons used to transport migrants who are being detained. Video towers that were constructed in many areas along the border starting in the late 1990s. This one is in Laredo, Texas. Infrared telescopes and video imaging equipment that is portable, located in the backs of pickup trucks that rove around the region. This is also back in Hidalgo County. Remote sensing locations where information is beamed back from the field to detention centers. Checkpoints along the principal routes leading away from the border that in effect become the real border in terms of the challenges that are represented to entering the United States. Never been that difficult to get into U.S. territory immediately across the river. What's more complicated in South Texas is getting out of the border region and past these immigration checkpoints along the highways. These can often have a lot of traffic backing up behind them at peak times. One of the contradictions that has to be overcome with a free trade agreement is the need to facilitate the movement, the quick, efficient, and mass movement of merchandise back and forth across the border, and also vehicles back and forth across the border, while at the same time heightening immigration enforcement and taking greater measures to try to detect the undocumented and the unauthorized. And this is one of the contradictions that the Homeland Security apparatus has been at pains to resolve. Drug-sniffing dogs, also they sniff people as well. They're trained to alert to the smell of people that they can't see in vehicles. The IDENT system, this computerized database system where people are photographed and fingerprinted, this was set up not originally to tie into criminal databases, although it is tied into FBI and other databases now,
but originally to fight against recidivism. In other words, Mr. Gonzalez getting caught in the morning, getting returned voluntarily, in quotes, to Mexico, coming back in the afternoon as Mr. Sanchez, and then coming back the next day as Mr. Perez. And the idea was that this will now be impossible for migrants to do because they'll pop up in the database, and if they do that, they can be charged with illegal entry of the United States, a criminal violation, and prosecuted for it. Cells in which up to 15 people were being held overnight in the Laredo North Detention Center in near Laredo, Texas. The graffiti that prisoners who were detained overnight would leave. One of the things that I find interesting there is these very wicked people who are being detained are not inscribing curses. They're not inscribing gang insignia and things of that sort, but rather are inscribing their names, their initials, maybe where they're from, et cetera. I thought that was sort of interesting. And this is also rather interesting. If you drive past the checkpoints and the highways leading away from the border, you get a signification of the achievements of the Homeland Security apparatus. And so it's always together. Drugs seized at this checkpoint. In this case, this would have been in 2008. 141,295 pounds to date that year, and 2,855 undocumented aliens. Kind of a hybrid version of the term illegal aliens, undocumented immigrant. No terrorist captures noted, perhaps because in fact there were none, or because the numbers are so small as it's not the kind of thing that you really need to quantify, because if you catch just one, that would in principle be enough. We were talking earlier about the private companies that are being used to transport and detain migrants in South Texas and elsewhere along the border. This is a bus that takes detainees from the initial detention center in McAllen to a Wack and Hut run facility in Raymondville, Texas. And they fill these buses up and take people overnight, mostly Central Americans or people that can't be voluntarily returned for some reason, either because they're minors or because they're not Mexicans and have to be transported to some other country. The other thing that we've seen, and several of you have alluded to this already, is the increasing criminalization of migration. And this comes from the Transactional Records Clearinghouse. This is from September 2009. People who are looking for reasonably good data on prosecution of immigration crimes can go there, and one of the things that we see is an exponential increase in prosecution of criminal immigration violations, most of which are for illegal entry and illegal entry after deportation. And it goes across now four administrations. You can see what the level was back at the early Clinton years, but it's you know, been rising fairly steadily. The first Bush, Clinton, the second Bush, and Obama breaking all the records so far. And the other thing that, of course, is interesting is where it always was the case in the federal docket, criminal docket, it was drug violations that were by far the majority of cases prosecuted. Today, by far, it is immigration violations. And then the wall. This is the wall on top of the levee that we were talking about a few minutes ago. You saw another angle photograph of this from Jennifer. This is down near Hidalgo, Texas. A lot of these photographs of enforcement operations are taken on field trips that I've taken my students on Border Patrol ride-alongs. This is the wall near Dona, Texas, where it's part wall and part fence, these slatted sheets of metal. And this is also near Dona, Texas, and you can see one of the openings here where a road goes through. Okay. In, like I said before, in my own study, I was looking at migrants from mainly traditional migrant-sending communities in Mexico, especially in the states of Nuevo León, Guanajuato, San Luis Potosí, and Tamaulipas. And they were making their crossings between Del Rio, Ciudad Acuña, and Boca Chica, down here the mouth of the Rio Bravo, Rio Grande, in the Gulf of Mexico. And what their experiences were contracting coyotes, what their experiences were physically as they made the trip, how they reconstructed their experiences, the discourses that they used to describe what they had gone through, etc. I want to show you this map, though, mainly so you get a sense of the real question that, or the real challenge facing migrants is not getting across the river, which even to this day is relatively easy to do, but getting past all of these checkpoints on the highways leading away from the river.
And one of the things that's important to understand, I think, for what's going on with laws like SB 1070 in Arizona and also the new law in Alabama and some other states and localities around the country is that in 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court basically carved out a special exception to the rights to be protected from unreasonable search and seizure, the Fourth Amendment, in the border region, and in particular authorized permanent checkpoints on the highways leading away from the border, saying it was in the national interest that these kinds of searches only in the border region would be permitted. I'm not an immigration or human rights attorney, and I know that the people from the clinic here, if I'm saying something that isn't quite right, correct me. But basically, that is how I understand it. A very good account of this can be found in Bill Ong Hing's recent book, Ethical Borders, a law professor and somebody who writes about immigration issues at the University of California, Davis. So once you get past, or once migrants got past these checkpoints and the very heavily patrolled area of South Texas, they weren't exactly home free to get onward to Austin, for example, or to Dallas, Fort Worth, or to Houston, or Chicago, or other points in the interior of the United States. But their risks of being detected dropped considerably. Okay, and so that is an important thing to bear in mind. Okay, so what I want to do is, because I don't, this book now came out almost 2 years ago, and I felt the obligation to do something new, right, and not just be repeating things that I've been saying now for years, is I have been having a lot of people ask me when I do talk about the book, students and people in presentations as well, well, hasn't everything changed? Look at what's going on in Mexico. The drug war that has, the violence in the drug war has changed everything. And now we're seeing massacres of migrants, mass kidnappings of migrants, et cetera. What do you have to say about that? And the answer is, in short, I have no direct research to report in order to comment on it in terms of research. But what I can do is I can, based on what I learned in my own study of Mexicans' experiences, talk about some ways we might want to think about what's going on and the kinds of hypotheses that we might want to pose about how we would, you know, try to determine exactly what's happening in Mexico in particular, and by extension in some places in the United States. Okay? So we have right now lots of other Latin Americans migrating through Mexico on their way to the United States. Renee, you gave a figure this morning of about 150,000? About 150,000 a year. So these are numbers from the middle of the last decade, basically 2006, 2007. It's dropped off considerably since then.
Was 2005 with 450,000.
Okay, so this is, it's come down a little bit, as everything has, presumably due to the recession more than anything else, but also perhaps due to fears of transiting Mexico. Mostly they're from Central America, but also from other places in Central and South America and the Caribbean, and almost all of them are undocumented. The migrants in transit. I'm not saying that there aren't other Latin American migrants that go to Mexico as tourists or go to study or to become permanent residents in Mexico. But of these numbers, almost all are undocumented, okay, in Mexico. And the most of the violence that is befalling migrants in Mexico seems to be occurring in the southern part of the country, and especially in this sort of southeastern and eastern corridor heading up towards the Texas border. And by the early 2000s, the majority of Central Americans coming to the United States were passing through the Texas border. It varies from year to year. There were Central Americans also going through California and Arizona, et cetera. But there were a lot of Central Americans, to the point where, very briefly, Central Americans were outnumbering the number of Mexicans that were being apprehended by the Border Patrol in certain parts of South Texas. So we have this issue about the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which basically says, you know, unreasonable searches and seizures violate somebody's constitutional rights, okay? And one of the effects of that is that in the United States, these routine highway checkpoints where anybody can be questioned about their immigration status and where anybody can have their vehicle searched without probable cause, only reasonable suspicion is required, that it's only in the border region where that is, the exception is carved out. Once you're out of the border region, the state does not automatically have a compelling interest that allows them to conduct these kinds of searches, random or otherwise, okay? So there has to be probable cause outside of the border region, okay? So that is something that I think, you know, has been very important to advocates of immigrant rights in the United States. One of the things, though, that we see in Mexico is that, and I'm not an expert on the Mexican Constitution, but de facto in Mexico,
interior checkpoints over the last 10 to 15 years have been quite common. And any of us that have driven in Mexico have probably had the experience of going through military checkpoints, police checkpoints, in some cases immigration checkpoints. But in all these checkpoints, documents can be, you can be required to produce documents. Renee told us this morning that that's now changed, that only the Instituto Nacional de Migración can, you know, request to see those documents. But up until now, that any public official or any agent of security could request those documents and frequently did. And so we see these kinds of checkpoints in Mexico. These are not photographs I took. These were scoured from the net. But checkpoints in interior areas in Mexico. This is comes from a newspaper website from 2008, if I'm not mistaken. And this is a translation from what they said. Early on Saturday morning, immigration agents in the municipio of Tenosique, in conjunction with police from the town of Balancan, and a routine inspection, and I emphasize routine inspection, arrested 32 undocumented Central Americans that were being transported on a bus, on a public bus, on the TRT line that covered the Chamizal-Villahermosa route.
Just to clarify that, the one on the right is an immigration official.
Okay.
And they don't have guns. But
right.
The other guy is probably state police.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thank you for that. I wasn't aware of that distinction. And then, of course, the famous La Bestia. And as Renee pointed out earlier this morning, the migrants who are riding La Bestia are frequently the poorest of the Central American migrants that attempt to make the trip. Although many of them are, in fact, guided by coyotes on this train. I recently had the chance to debrief with a researcher who's a doctoral candidate at Cornell University who's been riding the trains and is writing her dissertation about how the system of transport is organized, more organized than one might think, on the train itself. And that'll be a very fascinating dissertation for us all to read when it comes out. But the point is that the reason they're riding the train is to get around the checkpoints on the highways because they're undocumented. Okay. Now, if you pay, a better coyote, but a more expensive coyote, that coyote or that group of coyotes is likely to have contacts that will allow you to pass through the checkpoints by bribing officials or by scaring officials so that they'll let your people go through on public buses, etc. Okay? But the people who are riding La Bestia, they're not doing it because most of them are so destitute they can't afford a coyote, but rather they are traveling with coyotes who are not such high-level coyotes that they are able to negotiate the official checkpoints on the highways. And this has become an issue that human rights advocates in Mexico have been complaining now for at least the last decade. And this is just a translation of one of the posters. This, I think, comes from Sin Fronteras in Mexico City. And how much do they shake you down for on your way to work? Talking about the extortions that occur on the trains. More than 100,000 Central American women and men cross the southern border of Mexico each day. It should be each year. They said each year. I made a mistake there. In search of a decent living, around 80% suffer some type of violence at least once on their journey. And so now, in 2007, at Trinity University, we were blessed to have not a sitting Mexican head of state visit us, but a recently sitting Mexican head of state, Vicente Fox, come and give a talk to a large auditorium filled with students, faculty, but many more people from the community who greeted his arrival with a great deal of reverence. He was, for many people in San Antonio, regarded as sort of the Mexican Jorge Washington for having overturned the PRI and returned Mexico to democracy, etc. And in his address, he talked about the migration issue, and he talked about a number of other issues. And got lots of questions from people in the audience, people who wanted their daughters to be photographed with him, and the daughter would run up onto the stage, and he'd hug her, and they'd take a picture, and all these things. But one rather hostile question, and it came from a Mexican-American priest, and it had to do with the treatment of Central Americans in Mexico. And the question was, my name is Brother Ricardo Lopez, and I'm a missionary of the Order of Mary Immaculate. I have a question that I've held for many years. You pledge for the legality of people here, of the immigrants in the United States, full respect for human rights and labor rights, and all the while during your presidency, and I believe this continues today, undocumented immigrants who come into Mexico from countries south of Mexico, they are treated abysmally.
How can this be reconciled? And mis padres son dos mexicanos, inmigrantes ilegales. But we expect them to be treated one way, and yet we treat our neighbors to the south very differently. So how can we reconcile this? Okay.
And Vicente Fox answers, and he answers quite sincerely. And he answers in one that, for those of us who've been studying the question of migrant rights, it really took our breath away. And we can talk about why. He says, I have to accept that we might not have been so consistent, but the instructions, the strategies, the programs were for respecting human rights. Maybe it's interesting for you to know that about 350,000 to 400,000 Mexicans cross the border every year. Some of them return to Mexico, some others find their way here in the United States. And by the way, they find it because someone hires them, because they can have an income, because this economy needs them. But there are 250,000 Central Americans that we get in Mexico, we hold, and then we send them back to their respective countries. 250,000! We built the most modern facility in Tapachula, Chiapas, supervised by the Commission for Human Rights, so that when we hold these Central Americans coming, we give them shelter, we give them food, we give them beds, and for the time that they're staying there, which is no more than 24 or 36 hours, and then we send them back. Okay? And he goes on and says,
and we have agreed with Central American governments, which I respect so much, I have such a good friendship and relationship with them, that they should open up consulates, as we have here in the United States, all throughout the southern part of Mexico, so they can see for themselves and they can demand full respect for these Central Americans coming into Mexico. Okay? Now, one of the things that was interesting to me is that he doesn't display any sense of irony about stating things in this way. In other words, As the head of a sovereign state, it is normal, natural, unquestionable that the sovereign state will control who comes into its territory and who can be allowed to stay, and that tracking down, detaining, and deporting migrants does not constitute in any way a violation of their human rights. Right? And we've noted already this morning that there's nothing in international law to suggest that presence by itself or transit by itself is a right in the international legal framework that we operate with. And so I just call your attention to this, that from his point of view, as the head of state, that there is nothing incongruous about this way of framing things, right? This is what all countries do. I was very interested to hear René say that in his experiences in Gobernación, no evidence whatsoever of U.S. pressure to have Mexico doing its, what we might regard as dirty work, checkpoints on the highways, et cetera. I don't know if things were different during the Fox administration. The presumption on the part of many of us was that there was some considerable pressure being exercised over Vicente Fox, especially when he first came into office, when he was pushing very hard for a migration agreement, a bilateral migration agreement with the United States. And the critique was made that in his attempts to get an agreement from the United States, one of the quid pro quos, whether it was actually made by the United States or it was simply perceived as a good strategy on the part of the Mexican government, was to make sure that Mexico could reasonably claim that it was doing something about migrants in transit on their way to the United States. Okay, and I'll be very interested in René's response to that. And again, this would have antedated your arrival in the government by about 10 years, so I'm not sure. I'm not implying that this is something that anybody in your office has been up to anytime recently. And then the question is, well, what about respect for human rights when we see the massacre at San Fernando, Tamaulipas, right? Who is responsible for this? And then other massacres of migrants that have taken place, right? Who bears responsibility? And what can be done about it, right? So make sure that this kind of horrendous event is not repeated. And
data are always, you always have to be a little suspect of the data that come out. According to Mexico's National Human Rights Commission, in 2010 alone, they documented 24 separate incidents of mass kidnapping of migrants traveling in the United States to the United States in 2010. Involving a total of 11,333 victims, which is an average of 53 migrants per incident. These are the ones that they've documented. I know there's been some debate between the Mexican government and the human rights organizations as to, for example, there was an event that took place in Oaxaca, I believe, last December, and then again in April, where human rights advocates were saying 110 people were just kidnapped, they've disappeared, and the government says we can find no evidence that this thing ever even happened. Right, so we are kind of in these gray areas where it's very difficult to get any kind of precise numbers or even to be sure what's going on.
which makes our task in assigning responsibility or beginning to think about responsibility and then what might be done in order to correct the situation all the more difficult. We're not operating with solid data. But this is something that's been reported time and time again in the Mexican press coming from the National Human Rights Commission. Okay? Now, methodological lessons that are important, I think, that I think are things that I would take from my own experiences in the field and apply them to trying to understand this question of violence against migrants in Mexico. Okay, first of all, the press especially, but also a disappointingly large number of researchers rely primarily on official government spokespeople, agents, or sources of data. Okay, and I'm saying this not to cast doubt on any of the, I think, very solid data that Renee presented this morning, but rather to say that two things. One is states have interests in presenting things in certain ways. A second thing is that states are not omniscient. And one of the things that's been very interesting to me to have done this research on Coyotaje is I would find myself being the only person who in the same day could walk from the office of a federal judge to talk to people in the Border Patrol, to then go and talk to a coyote, and then go and talk to an undocumented migrant all in the same day. The other people involved can't go and talk to one another and get information in quite that way. So government agents don't necessarily know everything that's going on, and they're only seeing things from their own limited perspective of it. Okay? So that's one methodological issue that we want to bear in mind. Another is reliance on news reports. And this has also been something that has been very troubling to me, the extent to which a lot of public policy researchers especially take what they read in newspaper reports as being fact and then use it to base analyses upon. The problem with this, especially when you're talking about these events that are taking place outside legal frameworks, is that what you end up doing in many cases if you're a reporter is you end up becoming something like a stenographer for the state, right, at worst, which is to say that, you know, something happens that you're going to report on that involves undocumented migration, right, and you've got a deadline tomorrow. You don't have a lot of resources that you're operating with. You need to get somebody that seems reliable to give you information, to make statements to you. And in the case, at least, of South Texas, the most likely place for you to go is going to be to some law enforcement official. And if I had a dollar for all the articles that I have seen in the San Antonio Express News or the Houston Chronicle or the McAllen Monitor that basically reported news simply based on a phone call made to a Border Patrol spokesperson, I would be a wealthy man today. Okay, so it's a very limited perspective you get from that. And then the other thing that happens is that reporters also have to be able to make themselves immediately intelligible with very tight space limitations to a readership that's not an expert on migration, nor are the reporters typically, right? So they have to rely on easily understood tropes, right, about what's going on. And the final piece of that puzzle is the problem that this is a capitalist press. We talk about the mainstream press, but we're really saying it's a capitalist press in the sense that these are organizations that are producing information for sale and are attempting to maximize their sales. This puts a lot of pressure, if not on reporters themselves, on editors who write the headlines to sensationalize. Okay, so these are some things that I think are important to bear in mind as we try to understand what's going on with events like the tragedy in San Fernando, Tamaulipas. And then a final methodological problem. There is a very good article that's come out in two places, once in Spanish in the Revista Norte America and also in the Applied Anthropology Journal Human Organization. In the past year by researchers at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Slack and Whiteford. And their stated purpose in their article is they want to document human rights violations and the suffering of migrants so that the wider world knows about it. A very laudable and very important project. They do this by going and interviewing people in migrant shelters about their experiences. And that is, of course, a very good way to find out about the crimes committed against migrants and the mishaps that befall them on their journeys north. It's a very bad way, however, to generalize about all migrants' experiences, and in particular their experiences as they relate to their coyotes. Why? because the migrants who are in the shelters, although this is not taking into account what Renee told us this morning, that most of them these days are returned deportees from the United States. But if you're talking about Centroamericanos, who were the bulk of the migrants that I would see in shelters in Huevo Laredo and Reynosa earlier in the 2000s, you know, these are the people that didn't make it. These are the people who had something bad happen to them along the way or couldn't complete their journey, right? And so you get a very good sense of what happens to people when things go badly, but you don't get much of a sense of what happened to all the other people who made it and what their experiences were, okay? So that's something else methodologically that I think is a limitation. If we're trying to make generalizations about the migration process today based on information we're getting only from migrant shelters, okay? And again, not suggesting that this is what Gobernacion is doing, but just for all of you graduate students who may be thinking about working on these issues, something to bear in mind. So, who is responsible for the violence suffered by migrants? Sorry, I need to go back. What are the types of violence that migrants might suffer? Johan Galtung, in a very famous framework now that he developed way back in the late 1960s, talks about different types of violence, direct or personal violence, right? You know, man beats husband, direct violence, right? Coyote rapes migrant, direct violence, right? Coyote assaults and robs migrant, direct violence. Border Patrol agent curses at and kicks migrant while in detention, direct violence. Almost all of the attention to violence that goes on as it relates to migration is about this kind of violence, okay? Structural violence, on the other hand, is the overall structure of society that sees to it, either intentionally or unintentionally, that some particular population in society is going to have its basic needs denied to them to such an extent that it prevents them from realizing their full human potential, right? That the inequality in society is a form of violence to the extent that it prevents people from developing fully and naturally, okay? And structural violence, you know, is a very flexible concept. It can be synonymous at times even with just plain social injustice, if you will, or certain definitions of institutionalized deviance. But in my own studies, I would argue that structural violence is responsible for most of the violence that befalls migrants in their journeys insofar as these Herculean efforts that they were having to make in order to make it around the barriers in their path often resulted in their injury, certainly a great deal of suffering, fear, etc. Much more important in terms of suffering on the overall scale than any direct or personal violence that they were subjected to en route. And the studies of migrant deaths that exist by Nestor and Wayne Cornelius and others have basically found something consistent with that. Cultural violence are the ideologies, the belief systems that justify either of the other two, right? So, you know, macho culture, beliefs, you know, about gender might justify wife beating, for example. Or, I think more importantly here, and this gets back to my sort of discussion of the lack of irony in what Vicente Fox had to say, is that border enforcement as a part, interdiction as a piece of national sovereignty becomes naturalized to the point that it's just not questioned in the discourse. It's just part of the background. It's part of the commonly held assumptions. It becomes common sense. Okay, so the other piece of violence that has been introduced, or the other type of violence is been introduced by Slack and White for these same researchers that were interviewing people in the shelters in Sonora, and they talk about post-structural violence. To be honest, I don't really understand exactly how it's different than any of these others, except that it involves elements of the others all at once. And so they talk about it as post-structural violence, suggesting that in a situation of structural violence and cultural violence, that structure, those types of violence influence people's individual behaviors, and that we might call the way those individual behaviors are influenced post-structural violence. Okay, I'm not convinced yet that this has any real analytical heft as a concept for us, but it's now in the literature, and you may see that around. And it may turn out to be a very useful concept, but I can't give you sort of real specific examples of its utility at this point. So, who is responsible for the violence suffered by migrants in transit? Well, what we hear often is that it's the smugglers. It's the coyotes in cahoots with the drug traffickers, and in particular, it's the drug trafficking cartels that have diversified their business and they have taken over human trafficking. That's one. Or is it just the drug cartels, right? And so that it's not really the coyotes, it's the drug cartels
directly, okay? The Mexican military, are they involved in some of this? Local and state police officers, Mexican immigration agents, the U.S. government, indirectly, if in fact the U.S. government has been pressuring the Mexican government to engage in certain kinds of tactics, or at a more general level, if the political and economic policies encouraged by the United States in the region and by companies based in the United States have the effect of displacing people in Central America so that they are more or less obliged to transit Mexico on their way to the United States? Or is it some combination of the above? Okay. So again, I don't necessarily have answers to these, but this is how I go about trying to think through what is it that we would want to be trying to figure out through empirical research. I do have some hypotheses, though, as they relate to coyotaje in particular, right? Because one of the things that I encountered in my own research was that coyotes were routinely blamed, uniquely often, for mishaps that befell migrants in their journeys to the United States by the press, the mainstream press, by government agencies, and sometimes also by human rights organizations. So what are some hypotheses about who is responsible that relate to some extent to this question of coyotaje? One hypothesis is that the Zetas have totally taken over the business of transporting Central American migrants through Mexican territory, right? In other words, that there are simply no independent coyotes left out there, that the Zetas have muscled everybody else out of the business, and that if you want to transit Mexico, and we could pick another drug cartel, but it's been the Zetas that have been pointed to most often, that, you know, basically if you want to transit Mexican territory, you're going to have to go with the Zetas or you're not going to go. One possible implausibility about this, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, the same was said about the Mara Salvatrucha. The Maras supposedly had muscled in and taken over the business of transporting migrants through Mexico, at least in southern Mexico, and you know, as a consequence, it had become much more dangerous for people to travel. The implausibility factor here is that if you had any other alternative at all, would you be willing to travel or have your family members travel with members of an organization that were known to be among the most fearsome thugs on the planet? And my gut says to me, if you had any other opportunity, you would pick it rather than travel with the Zetas. Okay? Another possibility is that the Zetas haven't taken over the whole business of transporting migrants, but rather they sometimes pretend to be coyotes at the border with the United States in order to press migrants into service working as burreros or mulas, hauling drugs across the border in exchange for transit. And I have come across a few cases of this inadvertently in the last couple of years. For example, a Guatemalan man who's the brother of somebody that I know wrote about his experiences where essentially he was taken by a coyote from Guatemala through Mexico, treated very well until being delivered to some apparent coyotes at the border who turned out to be I think not Zetas at this point, but the Gulf Cartel. He wasn't entirely sure. This was in 2007, and you know, was beaten, witnessed rapes, threatened at gunpoint. You know, had a horrendous experience coming across. But who did not blame necessarily his Guatemalan coyote for that? The question is, do the coyotes willingly, knowingly turn people, turn migrants over to people at the border that they know intend to do them ill? Another possibility is that the Zetas aren't directly involved in transporting migrants, but rather extort coyotes as they extort a lot of other businesses who transport migrants through territory under their control. They charge them the derecho de piso, right? In other words, you know, if you're the Zetas, why do you really want to get in the operational aspect of transporting migrants? It's a lot of work. There's a lot of risk of lost income that way. Much better that if you become aware of coyotes who are coming through your plaza, your area under control, that you charge them a fee for doing so, and quite a steep fee, okay? And the person I was mentioning is doing her doctoral research on migrants, Central Americans transiting through Mexico, has come across times when Zetas apparently have confronted coyotes that they didn't know were operating in their territory and shook them down for rather large sums of monies and warned them not to continue doing so without paying them. Another possibility is that the Zetas aren't involved. These aren't mutually exclusive, by the way.
The pesetas aren't involved in people smuggling directly, but rather they monitor the movement of migrants through Mexico and kidnap migrants from their coyotes in order to extort migrants' family members who live in the United States. Knowing that there's a COD system in place, whether it's a full COD system or a partial COD system, 15 migrants who are scheduled to pay, say, $6,000, their relatives are going to be paying their coyotes $6,000 when they get to Houston. 15 times 6, that's $90,000 in a day's work. That's a pretty juicy sum of money if you can manage to get a hold of these migrants, kidnap them from their coyotes. Another thing that this hypothesis, and both of these hypotheses, suggest is that, in fact, some of the deaths that we have seen in places like San Fernando, Tamaulipas, and also some of the kidnappings, may have included coyotes among their victims, as well as just being migrants. In other words, the presumption that it's the coyotes who are doing ill to the migrants, the coyotes may actually also be victims of these kinds of opportunistic crimes or this kind of extortion, or they may try to just save their own skins by giving their migrants over to these other gangs. And again, I don't know which of these is true, but these are the kinds of questions that I would ask. Coyotes and sectas aren't a single integrated unit, but rather collude with one another, whether routinely or only on occasion. Slack and Whiteford, in their research and their discussion of what they call post-structural violence in the Arizona-Sonora corridor, suggest that because, in part, this is a fairly narrow part of the border where a lot of migrants and drugs are being funneled through, that there is this sort of tactical collaboration, at least, that goes on between narco gangs and coyotes, for example, in the vans that transport people from Sasabe, Sonora, from El Altar to Sasabe and then to the border, that both drugs and people are being transported in those vehicles, not necessarily in the same vehicle, but the same vehicles contract themselves out to both coyotes and to narco-traffickers. Almost done. The other thing that becomes very important is that both coyotes and setas rely upon the collaboration of Mexican government agents in order to operate freely in Mexican territory. And in particular, this becomes worrisome with regards to the identification of migrants going through these many checkpoints in Mexican territory where they can be identified and be handed over to kidnappers. Now, we've heard a lot already about the new Mexican immigration law, and I think that Renee gave us a very, very good summary of its contents and also made very clear to us that we don't know yet exactly how it's all going to be implemented. There's the letter of the law, but then there are lots of practical considerations that are going to influence what actually happens on the ground. Okay, it decriminalizes undocumented immigration through Mexico. Okay, and probably most important, and this is one of the things that Renee mentioned that I think is a great advance, is it's going to provide special temporary visas for both workers and visitors from other Latin American countries, including transit visas. Okay, the idea being that people will no longer have to be on the bestia, for example. So that is a huge thing, and this, presuming that all the details can be worked out and that people from Central American countries who are of, rural people often, who are of scarce economic means, often not highly literate, will actually be able to get through whatever bureaucratic procedures are going to be required of them, whether in their own countries of origin or at the border with Mexico, in order to get these visas. And I presume that the Mexican government is going to make a good faith effort to make sure that that happens. It also, very importantly, provides for punishment of government employees that commit human rights abuses against migrants. The last piece of it, though, is the business of the checkpoints. And this is something that Renee didn't speak to, and I'd be interested in his comments on it. My concern is that even with a legal document that allows Central Americans to transit Mexican territory towards the U.S. border, that if there are still repeated checkpoints, I guess it'd be at this point only by the Instituto Nacional de Migración, that because there are lots of threats made against government officials, there are lots of attempts to bribe government officials, that there will be efforts made to hire, pay National Migration Institute officials in these checkpoints to serve as halcones for kidnapping gangs, right? And we know already that some of the people that have been liberated from having been kidnapped in Reynosa identified the INM inspectors as having being the people that fingered them on the buses in which they were traveling and turned them over to their kidnappers. And so one of the issues that will have to be confronted is, one, whether it makes sense to continue to have these kinds of checkpoints, not at the border, but in the interior regions of Mexico, and two, whether there will be enough a purging of the ranks of corrupt officials, both at the beginning of the new laws enforcement and throughout thereafter, to make sure that the plato plomo kinds of tactics that drug cartels often use with public officials don't work, and that people won't be getting fingered to potential kidnappers as they travel legally now through Mexico. So I thank you for your attention.
Okay, we'll open it up straight away to questions. Renee, do you want to?
So I have a lot of comments on David's presentation. I think it was very, very interesting. Talking about your hypothesis and the way at least I see you understanding the problem in Mexico, I would like to suggest two points, at least to enrich your hypothesis. One, I think really any kind of field work have to have very clear in mind that when you go and talk with migrant shelters and when you are really trying to understand who is coming to Mexico as migrants to go to the US, United States, is that you are not going to find everybody who is a migrant like we used to find in the past, somebody who is just coming to look for opportunity, to find a job, and survive, let me put it this way. It's really a mix of a lot of people. Prostitution, drug traffickers, Mara Salvatrucha escaping from different Mara Salvatrucha, since the border in the southern part of Mexico is basically open. Everybody's going through. Yeah. So when you find the train, when you find the shelters, when you find the road, it's a mix of people. Still, the majority are these migrant workers, but also you have more kind of complex composition of migrants. And the other one that is something that we also have to understand, but it can, at least I have the feeling in your presentation, is that something very local in Mexico, and it is not local. I mean, organized crime is a huge business all over the world, and human trafficking that involves Mexico now because of the market in the United States is growing very fast. So what basically the centers are doing there is that they're on the way and basically charging for what is happening. We are talking about people from India, from China, from Africa, coming to Argentina, to Ecuador, to Panama. All of them all gathered together in Guatemala, which all human trafficking, and they cross the border. And it's a very sophisticated part. They, some of them even fly with false documents and into Mexico. So it's to understand why this is happening in Mexico, and basically the forces behind that, is not only a matter of Mexico. Is something that is happening in Central America. Is something that is happening all over the world. It's a lot of money that, of course, can co-opt and produce more corruption in Mexican authorities than that. Since I took this job, I said, what is the right for free transit? Where can I find the legal basis to really grant? If somebody cross with no documents, he can really move within a country. There is no right on that direction. So the La Convención Internacional, the International Convention of Migrant Workers and Their Families, is the major point that everybody's kind of endorsing or ratifying, like Mexico, for that. And it clearly states that the free transit is only for citizens of the country or those who are regularly in the country, not for those who are irregular in the country. At least until now, we don't really have a framework where you can say, okay, it doesn't matter, you came into this country with no papers, you have the right. But also there is a philosophical question here, and that's how some migrant shelters and migrant human rights supported groups is that believe on, not all of them, is that no country can impose to other countries the rights of their own people. I mean, I can ask for solidarity, I can ask for humanity, a humanitarian perspective, but nobody can go to a different country and say, hey, my citizens have the right to be in your country and do this and this and this. So we have to be very careful because sometimes we understand in this kind of political activism that we can impose rights in other countries, and it's very hard to impose them. And you can apply that philosophical view to their own home and somebody comes to your home, it's how you behave, how are the rules mm-hmm. in your house or whatever. It's very hard to impose rights in other countries. What we can do again is to ask for solidarity, to really say that there are basic rights that are granted by international law, like due process, mm-hmm. yeah, consular protection, access to justice, mm-hmm. access to education, access to health, that we all should be providing without trying to find out if that person is legally or illegally in a country. In the way that we can, more countries push into that direction, and I'm saying that, I know this is more like in the letter now, in the Mexican migration law, but there are very few laws like the Mexican migration law all over Central America. No Central American country has a migration law like that yet. Hopefully we all move together in that direction. But that's, I think, the point. Basic human rights granted on the fact that you should have access to justice, to education, yeah, regardless of the irregular status you have in the country, but you cannot impose right. the right of being there because you're irregular.
Right. Well, I think, unless I gave a false impression or an impression that I didn't intend to give, I think that this new law is a great, great advance. And so my thing that I would hope that, you know, in your position these days would take back was to say, what's going to happen with these internal checkpoints? Even with a document, what new challenges is that going to present?
Yeah.
And so that's something that I think, you know, needs to be paid special attention to if we want to really be sure to put an end to these kinds of mass kidnappings.
I don't think the point is going to be more about the checkpoints within Mexican territory, but I think the discussion that is going to change with the new law is that if we have alternatives to detention, which is not to be in a detention center, especially for minors and women. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to put them in a detention center, estación migratoria, like the siglo XXI that Fox was talking about? That's going to be crucial. What other alternatives to detention we have? And second, what kind of detention centers we need? Because they are not criminals. They are not there because they really violated any major law in Mexico. So what kind of services this detention center should provide in terms of education, in terms of activities? But you go to Mexico now and you see a detention center, especially that one in Tapachula, it's like a jail. Yeah, it has all the security, everybody has to sleep in a special room. They lock it at night. With the new law, that has to change because that's still a consequence of the old framework. Those are the kind of changes that will come into Mexico little by little once we adapt to this different perspective on migration.
Yeah. I have a question about new law. On your contract, you say it's applying to Latin American populations. I work at an emergency shelter in Austin that works with asylum seeking populations of immigrants, but the majority used to come from Central America, and now the majority are coming from Nepal, India, Ethiopia, Eritrea. And they had, many of them have had really birth experiences in detention centers and jails in
right.
Mexico and have little or no respect for their rights.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen to them?
Last comment on that. The Indian population is very special, and most of the what we call nationals of third countries, for those who are not from Central America and South America, is a very difficult issue. They have to spend like 3 or 6 months in detention centers in Mexico because that's what they want. Why? Because they will never be recognized by the Indian embassy while they're standing there in Mexico. What they do, they come with papers all over to Guatemala. They throw, break them, all their passports and identifications, cross to the border to Mexico, and they ask to be detained. They ask to be detained because the Indian government will never recognize that they are citizens of India. So they have to spend 3 to 5 months in Mexican detention centers. They know they have to wait there. Once, because the law gives you a time limit, once we cannot really send them to India, we need to give them a permit for 30 days to leave the country. You have to leave the detention center. They have a special permit to stay for 30 more days, but leave the country. When they leave the detention center, the coyotes and the smugglers are waiting for them just to cross them to the United States. And And most of these migrants from Somalia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, come to the Texas border. Yeah, and that's what you're seeing that you mentioned about. But there is no way we can really repatriate them to their own country.
Why do they destroy their documents?
Because if you find them with a passport is from India, you don't have to go to the consulate to prove that he's from India. You can repatriate that person to India.
Yeah.
So once you don't have an ID that trace the citizenship, you cannot repatriate them to any country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why they don't want to be identified.
I don't think this was your intention, David, but in sort of contrasting the internal checkpoints that the United States has only within a certain region as opposed to throughout the
mm-hmm.
country, with secure communities and 287G, being pulled over for a broken brake light is
right.
now become an internal
exactly.
checkpoint in the United States.
Exactly.
And deportations are happening
right.
from the interior of the United States constantly as
yes.
ICE and local
yes.
police.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and I'm glad you said that, because one of the things I meant to mention, I think I didn't, is that one way to analyze, did I say this? One way to analyze things like SB 1070 is essentially individual states, and as you rightly point out, 287 and things like that, extending this constitutionally accepted area from the Fourth Amendment, right? And so that, you know, now in Phoenix, all over the state of Arizona, all over the state of Alabama, et cetera, the same much lower standards for detaining somebody and asking for their documents apply, and that is part of the conundrum, not conundrum, but part of the situation that we find ourselves in now with these state laws. What I was trying to get across in this presentation is that the structure of the situation matters, right? This new immigration law in Mexico, has the potential of really dramatically changing the structure of the situation, right? One of the things that has made Central American migrants so vulnerable in Mexico has been the fact that they have had to travel clandestinely and seek to avoid contact with the authorities wherever they can and rely upon people of questionable character, shall we say, to get them around all of the obstacles placed in their path in Mexico. Mexico has, after these terrible tragedies have occurred, has come to the realization, and I think people like Renee can take a lot of credit for this, has come to the realization that the structure of the situation, it's not just what's on the books, but it's also what's on the books and the way things are being enforced produces a structure of a situation that lends itself to acts of horrendous personal and direct violence being committed against people. And so I would hope, and I think that the goal of the Mexican government at this point is to try to change the structure of the situation of migrants in transit through Mexico so that they are not, as they have been up until now, so vulnerable to the depredations, not especially of the Mexican state or its agents, but in particular of people who are involved in organized criminal activity, some of whom are, incidentally, agents of the Mexican state, but not principally them. So I think that this is a big step forward. And I think, you know, as Ross Perot used to say about NAFTA, the devil is in the details, right? I mean, how is this thing going to be implemented? How are you going to overcome difficulties like what's going to happen in the northern border cities of Mexico with migrants who get that far, traveling freely through Mexico, and then find themselves unable to continue their journeys? Will they have the resources to go home at that point? Will they want to go home? What will happen?
And the law won't change how we Mexicans discriminate against Central Americans, and that's a very important point
also
about how they move and how they feel safe in Mexican territory, because they are, well, whatever we complain about what happened to us in the United States, we also do it in our own country.
And Central Americans are already very, very stigmatized in the northern border cities in Mexico. They get blamed for a lot of things, falsely blamed, generally, for things that go wrong. And if many more people start finding themselves stranded in Mexican border cities, I worry about what that will bring. Mister?
Well, I was just going to say it's about what's going to happen, but that's already happened. We've already written about the Central Americans and the northern border of Mexico, and they just overwhelm available social services, local organizations that try to work with them. And they get stereotyped, as you say. I just wanted to mention just a couple of points of information that people like Rodolfo Casillas, they've actually measured like the violence against the migrants. I mean, I was involved in research where we did PTSD measures of children who migrate by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
One of the studies I worked in was during the Civil Wars in Central America, which is dated now, and we did surveys of what experiences they experienced in Central America during the war, like that were potentially traumatic, and then what experiences they experienced during the migration by themselves, undocumented children. And we found that the numbers were the same, like 3.5 different experiences, not frequency. So that for the children migrating by themselves was like being in a war zone.
Yeah.
And just a final point here about does the U.S. did or does affect Mexico's enforcement on the southern border? And I'll just say that in the summer of 2001, Mexico implemented Plan Sur in the southern port. Thousands of Central Americans were repatriated to Guatemala. They were taken on buses and I guess El Salvador. I met with a Border Patrol chief who told me he designed Plan Sur in the U.S. Embassy, and he got the budget to pay for those buses. He said that during that summer that the apprehension of Central Americans on the U.S. border dropped by 27%. So, I mean, it was direct.
So that would be the smoking gun, as it were.
Yeah. he's retired, and I think he's written a book on his experience with the Border Patrol.
Well, so graduate students, you got your work cut out for you.
We need to.
It's a very safe piece of research.
Yeah,
for
yes.
So,
yeah,
so we can
better,
you
better
there
you
with
than
the
I.
University's blessing.
And if you want a copy of my book, I've got two copies at discounted prices.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.